All right, cool. Welcome. How many of you were here for the Science Tavern and it got canceled? All right, cool. Well, we're clearly braver than them, so. Sciencier too, yeah, totally. So just a couple of housekeeping things and then we're going to get to our speakers. We are doing a raffle tonight, and we're going to be raffling off these very cool winter-themed Surly Ramix necklaces. And so Christian, who's over there, is going to be walking around giving out raffle tickets, and then we'll do a drawing at the end of the thing. And raffle tickets are whatever you want to contribute, anything that doesn't jingle, preferably. All of the funds are going to go, well, unless you're going to give me like gold doubloons or something, I suppose that would be all right. What? Oh, car keys, yeah. If it's a good car, though. I don't. But all of the money that we're raising is for our Atlanta Skepta Camp, which is probably going to be in May of this year. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with what Skepta Camp is, but it's an unconference. They've been doing it. We did one last year. We've been doing it across the country for a couple of years now. And it's basically a way for people to get together and talk about skeptical topics. Everybody, it's modeled after the bar camp in IT. And the idea is you get together, everybody who participates, everybody who attends participates in some way. So either you volunteer or you do a talk or something like that. So it's a lot of fun. It's really interesting. We had a big group last year and it was a big success. So we're going to do it again this year. And Taylor Proctor is going to also talk about some other fundraising that we're doing for that as well.
So our next month, our Skeptics in the Pub is also a fundraiser for Skeptic Camp, which I guess Maria will tell you more about after I'm done. Next month, Skeptics in the Pub is a fundraiser for Skeptic Camp as well, and just kind of to help get things going with Skeptic Camp, this week, if you donate, make a donation to the JREF through a link that's on the Atlanta Skeptics website. Up to $150 this week through that site, I will match to donate towards Skeptic Camp. So it's awesome. So you can support JRF and we can start raising money for Skeptic Camp too.
So you get to give to two causes if you want to do it that way. Very cool. And next month, March 13th, so a month from today, we're going to be back in this room. We're going to be doing a very special guest live podcast of the Amateur Scientist Podcast. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Brian Thompson from the Amateur Science Podcast, but he's fantastic, very funny. He's volunteering his time to come and do this as a fundraiser. It's going to be a lot of fun and prizes and all kinds of fabulous stuff. We are charging, I think, $5 for attendance, but go to the Atlanta Skeptics site or the meetup for details on that, and you can actually pay online and do all of that. It's going to be a lot of fun. If anybody is interested in helping out with any of the stuff that we're doing, either with Skeptic Camp planning or with speaking at Skeptics in the Pub or anything like that, let me know or talk to Taylor, who's helping organize the Skeptic Camp side of things. And then the only final big thing is a big thank you to Mark Ditzler and Laverne over there from Abrupt Media, who are providing all of our AV stuff for free, as they always do, and they're just fantastic, and we are very appreciative of them. I still don't know why you guys show up and do that, but it's awesome. We appreciate you not having a life and hope that you continue to. And so I'm going to stop talking now, but I wanted to introduce, our speakers. Bob Blaskowitz is a Britain postdoctorate fellow at Georgia Tech. He is teaching a class right now on conspiracy theories. And Eve Siebert is a PhD in medieval literature, who's a currently employed English teacher. All right. Eve and Bob are actually writing a book together about a textbook on critical thinking. And I guess as research, they went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky over the Christmas holidays, I guess, to see the other side of things. But they're here to kind of talk a little bit about their experiences. So.
Okay. Hi, I'm Bob Blaskowitz.
I'm Eve Siebert.
Yep. The Creation Museum and its parent organization, Answers in Genesis, this is the museum itself. I should let you know that most of these images are not ours. We weren't expecting to be giving talks about this, so we only had our little camera phones with us, and they take really awful pictures, so we had to kind of crowdsource.
Steal. Borrow.
Pay homage to.
Yes.
Yes. So the Creation Museum and its parent organization, Answers in Genesis, are both run by the Australian transplant to Kentucky, Ken Ham. In Australia, Ham established the Creation Science Foundation before moving to the States in the late 1980s, when he took up with the Institute for Creation Research. In the mid-1990s, he founded in northern Kentucky what came to be known as Answers in Genesis. In recent years, since the opening of the museum in 2007, Answers in Genesis seems to have overtaken the Institute for Creation Research as the highest profile, I didn't say premier, highest profile American young earth creationist organization. It's an organization with global aspirations with an arm in Great Britain, and which will have an evangelizing away team at the Winter Olympics. Yep. I've had a morbid fascination with Answers in Genesis ever since the Creation Museum opened. It has a high-profile website, which puts out a disproportionately high volume of evangelical materials. Usually Ken Ham puts up a blog post just about every day, and at least one other staff member posts an article, publicly answers emails, or on Fridays, as you can see here on the News to Note bit, they post what they call a biblical commentary on the science news of the week that they failed to understand. Answers in Genesis promotes itself as being a science-based endeavor, and it boasts that it has numerous scientists on staff, including the astronomer John Lyle and molecular biologist Georgia Purdom, as if this were a good thing. They also sponsor, under the editorship of geologist Andrew Snelling, the Answers Research Journal, a creationist vanity publication which publishes articles from an exceedingly small number of authors who delight in citing one another, and many of whom are Andrew Snelling. Some memorable highlights of this novelty journal include Charles Krieger's argument for a young Mars, which suggested that perhaps Noah's flood occurred there too, and Desmond P. Allen's howler, an apology and unification theory for the reconciliation of physical matter and metaphysical cognizance, in which, quote, by coupling the metaphysical implications of quantum physics with the biblical understanding of God's attributes, the thesis is set forth that our immediate physical reality, consisting of empty space, electromagnetic energy, and information, is basically a hologram depiction of God's intent. God spoke, and it was so. Since creation, God's spirit has continued to energize and interact with the universe in an entangled nature at the quantum level.
What?
If that's not freshly squeezed 100% pure concentrated woo-woo, then I don't know what is. In general, however, the conceptual underpinning of the Answers in Genesis research project, if it can be said to have a coherent research project in the biological sciences, has to do with the study of baraminology. Baraminology takes its name from baramin, a compound word that the Kentucky creationists translate as created kind, but which is meaningless in Hebrew. The Encyclopedia of Life Sciences defines baraminology as... Oh, wait, it doesn't have an entry on baraminology. In fact, when you search all the biology databases at Georgia Tech, you find exactly zero references to Behrmann's or Behrmannology. As such, it has clearly failed to establish itself as a respected field of science. Behrmannology most closely resembles descriptive taxonomy, except that the taxonomic categories seem only to serve to explain one nagging question that snaps at the heels of all biblical literalists. How did Noah fit pairs of every single animal on the planet onto a single boat? The Behrmanns, therefore, may be functionally described as, quote, well, not quote, this is me. I quote myself because I'm big news.
Occasionally forgets to cite himself, though, and he gets very angry.
I know. It's so rude. But whatever grouping allows specimens of what became all the modern species to fit onto the ark. This is peculiar because it actually necessitates accelerated post-diluvian evolution from which man, for no readily apparent reason, is exempt. Armed with this knowledge and no doubt aided by a bottle of wine, Eve and I agreed that a visit to the Creation Museum was in order. Perhaps because of the wine, there's some dispute among experts about whose great idea this was. At any rate, nobody has taken responsibility for suggesting that we stop by the museum on the way back from St. Louis after Christmas.
Strictly speaking, the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, just outside Cincinnati, is by no definition on the way from St. Louis to Atlanta, as you can see. We're English majors, we're not good with the directions. Nevertheless, we packed up our own examples of God's creation, two very unhappy cats, and by the way, I'm surprised Noah didn't just decide the flood's better after a fairly short period of time.
Yeah.
And began our journey at 4:30 in the morning because we did not want to miss a single thing at the museum. In the early afternoon, we dropped off the cats at our completely appalling motel room and made our way to the museum, where we found an enormous parking lot filled with cars from all over the country. The museum was very crowded. We estimated, and we're totally making up this number because we're not good with numbers either. Again, English majors.
Or parking.
Yeah, that's true. So we estimated around 500 people. It may have been unusually crowded because between Christmas and New Year's, kids were out of school, the ones that aren't homeschooled, and many people were off work. But still, it's clearly a very popular destination. Guards with dogs were roaming through the crowd. Now, the dogs were black labs, not the fiercest looking animals in the world. But it was still kind of off-putting.
They could give you a hell of a nuzzling.
You get whipped by a tail of a happy black lab, you'll be walking funny for quite a while. At any rate, the Creation Museum's grounds are huge and quite beautiful and include botanical gardens, a koi pond, a lake, a waterfall, and a petting zoo. The petting zoo features a zonkey and a zorse. That's apparently the zorse when it was a baby. I know, it's adorable. It also has wallabies, which according to the sign were provided by the Ham family, but they were hiding. Oh, and yes, the Creation Museum is available for weddings and birthday parties. Yeah, I'm not sure about the bar mitzvahs.
Bar mitzvahs.
The museum is 70,000 square feet and costs $27 million to construct. Every single cent of the money came from donations. Although there were some large contributions of around $1 million apiece, supposedly 75% of the cost came from smaller donations of around $100 each. Admission is $21.95 for adults for one day. A two-day pass is a snip at $29.95. The Stargazers Planetarium costs an additional $7. It's $8 if you just want to go to the planetarium. Now, we did actually pay for the planetarium show, which at this time featured a show on the Star of Bethlehem. But by the time we'd exhausted all the other delights of the museum, we still had over 2 hours left until the start of the show. All the earlier shows had sold out. So we went back to our cats. So what artifacts do you get to see for this not inconsiderable outlay of money? Well, there's a few. There's a replica of Lucy, a few real fossils, apparently, a meteorite, a 19th century Torah that had survived Nazi Germany, which is on loan, a facsimile of an old Bible, which is on loan, Ken Ham's dinosaur stamp collection by the bathroom, woohoo, and Ken Ham's father's Bible with copious notes. But that's about it. Otherwise, there are lots of dinosaurs, some of which are animatronic, little rooms showing short films, television screens talking at you on a continuous loop, endless audio loops of various passages from the Bible and other pearls of wisdom, and lots of signs to read. In fact, the Creation Museum expects you to do an extraordinary amount of reading. Now, I like reading, English major, but I could read the same information in more detail for free from the Answers in Genesis website without having to crane my neck to look over some guy's shoulder. The slow readers caused massive pedestrian bottlenecks, and I did have a few uncharitable thoughts about the reading abilities of creationists. I'll pass over those. And while you're reading, you hear the endless audio loops and the video loops going on in the background. So it can sort of be a kind of sensory overload.
Because of this assault of information, it sure does feel like an assault, the Creation Museum needs to be well organized. Unfortunately, the exhibit area of the Creation Museum almost completely defies all known forms of sequential organization. The most infamous parts of the museum are the life-size mannequins of Old Testament figures, many of whom are mingling with dinosaurs. Behold the mingling. And it's good. And for some reason, perhaps because I expected the layout of the museum to make sense, I thought the story of Genesis was going to be told chronologically, but this was not the case. In fact, the organization was so cluttered I had to resort to outside descriptions to make any sense of what I'd seen. Once you've paid, an older gentleman with a camera thrusts you in front of a green screen and tells you you're going to have your picture taken with imaginary dinosaurs. As they take two shots, or they take two shots, and in the second one you're supposed to look scared. You're told that your pictures will be available for purchase as you leave. We didn't purchase photos, so I'm using an image of Kirk Cameron here. Notice the fine acting. But even if you don't purchase prints, he assures you, the Creation Museum somehow swings a donation for every photo taken. As you approach the entrance to the tour, you're greeted by a little animatronic dinosaur puppy wagging its tail. A sign introduces you to the seven C's of God's plan, creation, corruption, catastrophe, confusion, Christ, cross, and consummation. I would have said that this was the organizational plan of the museum if they hadn't started out with confusion. That is, by raising questions about the validity and moral status of evolutionary science. In a glass case across from the happy little dinosaur is a collection of finches. The sign beneath the cage states, scientists are puzzled that there is such a variety of finches, to which the appropriate response is clearly, the hell they are. We hadn't even gotten into the main exhibit and they'd already broken a commandment. Indeed, it's a telling travesty that they selected finches. It was, after all, Darwin's observations. He would have been 201 yesterday, right? Darwin's observations of the finches in the Galapagos that informed his extremely compelling argument for common descent based on biogeographical distribution of species. I managed to say biogeographical. I had the hell of a time trying to figure it out earlier. But anyway, you next entered, I'm sorry?
No, you said it twice.
Yeah. I'm getting pretty good at that word. You next enter a mock-up of a forest ranger station where there are two pictures, the first showing a muddy gully and another showing the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon. On a loop, the narrator tells you over and over that the exact same process created these two features on a human time scale. The first image was not a canyon by any stretch of the imagination, and what the narrator describes as soft rock looked a lot like mud. In fact, it's what paleontologist Daniel Phelps called unconsolidated ash. The suggestion that these two features could be sculpted by similar processes in such an abbreviated time scale is the first of a number of ludicrous juxtapositions throughout the attraction. Throughout Answers in Genesis's, I just kind of want to say biogeographical again because that sounds weird. Answers in Genesis's publications, you encounter the claim that, quote, everyone has the same evidence, and that young Earth creationists simply interpret the evidence differently, and by implication, correctly. The next section of the tour introduces you to the screaming false dichotomy that permeates the entire tour. You enter a chamber where two mannequins are excavating a dinosaur. The man in the middle of the exhibit looks suspiciously like Jack Perkins. The picture of the exhibit is from NCSE. I made the other part. But it's apparently modeled after a real nameless person who appears as a guide in videos elsewhere in the museum. He tells us that while he interprets the fossils using God's word, which is constantly described as an eyewitness account of creation, apparently they did not get the memo about anecdotal evidence, his little Asian friend, the only Asian in the place while we were there, uses human reason. Throughout, God's word and human reason are placed in opposition. We do not see the Asian scientist again. In the next room, the exhibit argues for the inerrancy and authority of the Bible. Osama bin Laden, a bearded Bill Maher, and George Harrison, portraying Abraham, Moses, and King David, respectively, carry with them the revealed word of God, and George Harrison, of course, playing a liar. Now, then the exhibit shows how far America has fallen away from this revealed word. There's a little film about the 1925 Scopes trial, but Answers in Genesis' peculiar perspective seeps into the telling when they describe the outcome of the trial. Quote, before a worldwide audience, the famous lawyer Clarence Darrow, a well-known agnostic, used the courtroom to attack Brian's view of the Bible. In the end, the ACLU failed to overturn the law, but it set a precedent. The Bible had been ridiculed in open court. I'm not sure they know what set a precedent means, but that's okay. The Bible had been ridiculed in open court. Clearly, even though it is only the literalist interpretation of the Bible that is set up for ridicule, and really then only in the court of public opinion, the museum confuses its interpretation of the Bible with the Bible itself. I've heard Georgia Purdon say many times that she is, you know, not interpreting. This is a problem throughout the solipsistic theology of Answers in Genesis. The outcome of all this Bible mocking is the subject of the next section, which shows how awful everything is these days. Walking down a mock-up of a dark alley, we learn that the teaching of evolution, or at least turning away from biblical literalism, leads to slight urban decay and some goofy graffiti. In an especially voyeuristic display of the museum, you peek into the windows of a house and watch the destruction of families on video screens, where parents are openly disagreeing in front of their children, and a girl is apparently ordering an abortion over the phone. Once you have passed through the hell we have wrought, you stumble through a pitch black corridor. A time tunnel 6,000 years into the past. You stagger out, bruised, into a prelapsarian paradise. Hey, there's Adam. He's naming the animals, see? He just came up with lamb and puma and warthog and penguin. A Mesopotamian penguin of paradise. They don't show us the fossil evidence to support that one. Despite the abundance of sheep, Adam is lonely. So in the next display, God creates the woman, who is a much better partner. You see? Yeah, I know. But the splendor in the conspicuously waist-high grass does not last forever. There is a snake in that grass. Well, actually, he's in a tree. You can see him in the upper middle corner. He's pretty gnarly looking. So he's in the tree. As you can see, Adam and Eve are in the Jacuzzi of Eden, where patrons have been flicking coins at the naked people.
Oh,
go back.
Shoot.
Nope, hold on, we're good. We're good. It's actually a fairly sensual scene, and you really can't see it in the image, or the image. But the fruit is knowledge berries, and the woman's hands are stained red. So there's actually a little symbolism in the exhibit, which was a refreshing change of pace. In the section following the fall, the narrator, again stuck in a loop, makes a very curious assertion. They tried to cover their shame, so they made clothes of fig leaves, but the fig leaves could not pay for sin. The penalty for sin is death, so the solution had to involve death. So God replaced the fig leaves with clothes made from animal skins. This was the first blood sacrifice. But an animal's death can only cover sin. It cannot pay for all of the sins of humans. This first sacrifice was a picture of a permanent solution that God would provide in sending the Son of God as the ultimate sacrifice for us. As far as I can tell, this is in every way totally made up. There's no mention of a sacrifice in Genesis chapter 3, verse 21. God made the clothes, yes. An animal presumably died. But to whom did God sacrifice it? Himself? For biblical literalists, they've built up an awful lot of mythology around one sentence that doesn't use the words kill, blood, or sacrifice. After all, it's conceivable, by their reckoning anyway, that since sin and death had entered the world, the animal had had a heart attack or an aneurysm or something. For people who consider the Bible to be a clear, absolute, and inerrant guide to life, the universe, and everything, they seem compelled to explain it to those who might get the wrong idea from actually reading it. Indeed, the museum has patently absurd answers for the really, really basic questions any skeptic would ask. For instance, who did Cain marry?
Among the acres of text the Creation Museum expects its visitors to read is an interesting sign that asks exactly this question. How did Cain get his wife? The author concludes that Cain's wife was probably his sister, even though such relations are quite specifically forbidden by biblical law.
He had to get her drunk.
Fortunately. Yeah. That bit of the Bible comes later. The sign about Cain's wife demonstrates a typical tactic of the Creation Museum and Answers in Genesis. That is, they attempt to use science to defend their point of view, but end up retreating to the position, well, God can do what he wants. He's God. Ken Ham and his acolytes believe science supports creationism and try to use science-y language, even when they don't have to and, let's face it, probably shouldn't. In the case of Mrs. Cain, they argue that incest would not have been a genetic catastrophe because humanity was only in its second generation, and Adam and Eve were created as perfect beings. The farther back in history one goes, back towards the fall of Adam, the less of a problem mutations in the human population would be. At the time of Adam and Eve's children, there would have been very few mutations in the human genome. Thus, close relatives could marry, provided it was one man for one woman, the biblical doctrine of marriage. I know, it gets better. After offering a scientific explanation of why incest was all right in this case, however, they conclude, since God is the one who defined marriage in the first place, God's word is the only standard for defining proper marriage. People who do not accept the Bible as their absolute authority have no basis for condemning someone like Cain for marrying a sister. Or to summarize, it all makes perfect sense scientifically, but even if it doesn't, who are you to question God in the Bible anyway? It may be noted that according to the Creation Museum, God's definition of marriage has changed over time when it seemed convenient to him. At one time, God's definition permitted incest. Now it does not. At one time, God's definition permitted polygamy, although they don't quite seem to admit that. But now it does not. It's curious that those behind the Creation Museum are so positive that they know what God's current definition of marriage is, but they're very positive that it is, in fact, one man and one woman.
And speaking of marriage, the next section of the museum is devoted to the third C, catastrophe. Oh, that was funnier than you thought. Yeah, you're going to think about it later, and you're going to laugh. Here they take a whack at geology, and I can tell you, creation geology is a lot more action-packed than normal geology. None of this gradualist nonsense for the creationists. Oh no, continents are flying around, and there are floods and earthquakes and volcanoes and all sorts of crazy cataclysms. And after the animals stumble off of the ark, they presumably sprint around the planet trying to get in their current ecosystems. Here also is the famous 51-foot-long section of fake ark under construction by male mannequins. In this section, they also have a 1/100th scale model of the ark, and to tape voices of the presumably doomed workers in the scaffolding around the Ark sound like Borscht Belt comics. What? It's going to rain?
And I noticed also that they have had a sign on the Ark asking, how big was the Ark?
Yeah.
So in case the kids needed to ask their father just how big the Ark was, he'd say, go look at the sign. At any rate, following catastrophe is confusion. Duh. Namely, the Tower of Babel and the subsequent dispersal of the nations. Here we encounter an especially glaring and abhorrent example of hypocrisy. In their attacks on evolution, the museum conflates the theory of evolution with social Darwinism and accuses Darwin and other proponents of evolution with all sorts of unpleasantness. Specifically, they say that evolution supports the idea that there are inferior races. These arguments aren't new, and a glance at Ray Comfort's introduction to The Origin of the Species, which is visiting from its usual place on the floor of our bathroom.
That's why she's holding it like this.
Well, yeah, we'll remind you of those arguments. Of course, even if every single one of these accusations were true, which of course they're not, they would still be irrelevant. Darwin could have been a serial killer in his spare time, and it would have no bearing on the validity of the theory of evolution. To be fair, sometimes atheists use similar tactics against theists. The excesses of the Inquisition, for instance, don't prove that Christianity is wrong or inherently evil. The problem with the Creation Museum, though, is its hypocrisy. It contrasts racist evolution with creationism, which they claim reveals that we are all one race. And looking around at the crowd of the Creation Museum, I realized it's true. We were all one race. White. More importantly, though, they blame Darwin and the theory of evolution for misinterpretations and misuses of the theory, but ignore the possibility that Christianity has ever, in its entire history, been used to justify racism or other social evils. But in the tower, the exhibit on the Tower of Babel, we encounter an example of how the Bible has been misused to justify exactly the type of racism that the museum blames on evolution. According to the Bible, Noah's sons became the progenitors of the human race. But in a mostly non-biblical tradition, the descendants of Japheth are said to have gone to Europe, the descendants of Shem to the Middle East, and the descendants of Ham to Africa. The Creation Museum has a map showing the migrations which occurred after the confusion of Babel. They conveniently leave out some of the important repercussions of this tradition, however. According to the Bible, after the ark landed safely, Noah got all drunk and naked. His son Ham saw him naked, and Noah cursed Ham's son Canaan and his descendants. You know, the ones who went to Africa.
Those.
Them. And this is what he said. Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brother. Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. For centuries, black skin was considered the sign of Noah's curse. The tradition has been used to justify African slavery and all sorts of racism. Again, it's not fair to blame Christianity as a whole for such racism, but it seems remarkably hypocritical for the designers of the Creation Museum to invoke this tradition, scrub away its unfortunate ramifications, and then sell books like Darwin's Plantation in the bookshop. The racist interpretation of the Bible was pointed out when the museum first opened. Nonetheless, it remains on their wall today.
The last three C's, Christ, cross, and consummation, appear squished together at the end of the tour. This seems strange, especially since these last bits are fairly important in Christianity. Notably missing from the static recreation of the discovery of the empty tomb were any women, you know, the ones who found that Jesus had rather unexpectedly skipped town.
See those not women there?
Yeah, well,
you just can't like, tell.
I don't know. I know we left them here. And
that's Peter and John. Isn't it supposed to be Peter and John?
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, the only woman who gets a place in the museum after Eve are relatives of Noah who are weaving baskets in the corner. Oh, gosh. Okay. I don't know why that's so funny to me. while the menfolk climb around on the scaffolding around the ark. At the end of the main exhibit area, you encountered the Dragon Theater. By this point, the Creation Museum has offended biologists, geologists, paleontologists, archaeologists, historians, paleolinguists, physicists, chemists, women, most theologians and biblical scholars, and civil rights activists. But in the spirit of inclusiveness, in their last movie, they set their sights on pissing off medievalists, folklorists, and all English majors everywhere. And boy, did they succeed.
Clearly, dinosaurs play an important part at the Creation Museum. He's so happy.
He looks like he's going to sneeze.
Yeah. But he's kind of happy about it.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs are everywhere. Outside, at the time we were there, they were decorated with Christmas lights. Inside, in the Garden of Eden, of course. On the Ark, of course. Everywhere. They're everywhere. Part of the reason, I imagine, is commercial. People, especially children and males, love dinosaurs. In addition, the loud, roaring, animatronic dinosaurs emphasize the scariness after the fall. For some reason, they do get more active after the fall. Everything's better after the fall, really. The dinosaurs were better? Yeah. Anyway. But the dinosaurs are also central to the argument for a young Earth. Now, there are some difficulties with this, like the evidence. But that's all right, because they explain the evidence from a biblical perspective. On top of that, they have documentary evidence. Specifically, they got dragons. Yeah. In September, Bodie Hodge, Ken Ham's son-in-law and a leading light at Answers in Genesis, gave a lecture at the Creation Museum entitled Dinosaurs, Dragons, and the Bible. Tragically, we missed that. But fortunately, we did see the 10-minute film Dinosaur and Dragon Legends in the Dragon Theater. Creationists look for accounts of dinosaurs coexisting with humans, and they find answers in tales of dragons and other mythical beasts. Predictably, the first book they look in is the Bible, where they find Behemoth and Leviathan. As I recall, they ignore the dragon in Revelation because they're not that interested in the New Testament, for some reason. Many explanations of Behemoth and Leviathan have been proposed. Some scholars have suggested that the descriptions in the book of Job refer to real animals in somewhat poetic form, though most consider them to be mythological beasts with symbolic significance. Many young Earth creationists consider them to be real animals, that is to say, dinosaurs. In the case of Behemoth, a huge, strong herbivore, they place great importance on the description of the animal's tail, which is said to be like a cedar. That's a lot of, and as you can see, they have based their argument on a cartoon from a children's book.
Yeah.
And we're not sure, the little figure down there is either God the Father, James Randi, or Santa.
Sure.
We're just not sure. They claim that such a description of the tail like a cedar would be inappropriate for real animals like elephants and hippopotami, which have skinny tails. However, in the new revised standard version of the Bible, the line is, it makes its tail stiff like a cedar, so it's possible that the description does not refer to the tail circumference anyway. Regardless, the creationists are pinning all their hopes on a poetic description and a cartoon. The description of Behemoth is too vague to identify. The description of Leviathan is quite detailed and includes this tidbit. From its mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap out. Out of its nostrils come smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. Its breath kindles coals, and flames come out of its mouth. Sounds like a dragon. Doesn't sound like a dinosaur. Moreover, the context for these descriptions is God's assertion of his power after Job has had the temerity to question him. God asks, have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his? The descriptions of Behemoth and Leviathan are expansions of that question. God's mightiest creations symbolize his power. The film then asserts that many references to dragons the world over suggest that dinosaurs survived well into the Middle Ages at least. So Chinese dragons are representations of dinosaurs, as are European dragons. First of all, the idea of Western and Eastern dragons could be called an example of convergent evolution of mythology. That is to say, while representations of Eastern and Western dragons do have some similarities, these are essentially coincidental. It's possible to trace their development to a certain extent, and they have different sources, and they develop separately. It's just when Westerners saw Chinese dragons, they went, ooh, dragons. And that's why we call them dragons. Basically, they belong to different kinds, or baramens, to use language that the Creation Museum would understand. Furthermore, while some dragons may in some ways seem similar to some dinosaurs, as well as snakes, lizards, birds, and fish, the similarity is again often coincidental, and in many ways dragons are quite different from dinosaurs or any real animal. For instance, while Chinese dragons can fly, they often don't have wings, and when they do have wings, they're little itty-bitty wings that wouldn't actually get you off the ground if you're a big, huge dragon. Meanwhile, European dragons often breathe fire, hoard treasure, and kidnap princesses. I'm not a real dinosaur expert. I've been asking what variety of dinosaurs, you know, went for the hoarded gold.
When we find the fossils around the gold hoard,
yeah.
then we'll talk.
So far, and of course, the princess, I don't know. The other place where the Creation Museum focuses on dragons is in the large Dragon Hall bookstore, the large inevitable Dragon Hall bookstore. As the website says, don't miss the chance to explore dinosaurs and dragons in this richly themed medieval environment while you browse through a wide range of gifts, toys, and books. You can see a large literate dragon over one door, because the dragons, they love to read, and Beowulf over the other. And that's actually quite a good sculpture. It's very accurate.
It even has a little
battle piglet on his helmet. Battle swine is the more mature word for it, manly word. According to this book, Bill
Wrong.
Cooper's After the Flood.
Dude, we're totally at PZ now.
Yeah, I know. Which is sold in the bookstore, and which, according to the volunteer who sold it to us, is a little technical.
It's true.
Beowulf actually slew several dinosaurs because apparently Grendel and his mother were, like the dragon, dinosaurs. Anyway, considering the focus on dinosaurs, you would think the Creation Museum would have a lot of kid-centric activities. Maybe figure out where PZ is coming up. At the time we visited, however, there were few interactive exhibits aimed at children. There is, of course, the notoriously saddled Triceratops, which PZ Myers wrote, which is only supposed to be written by children. And there was a puzzle of some sort, and of course the petting zoo. There also apparently were some, I don't know, knee biter displays or something, knee high displays, but those were making the little kids read a bunch of signs, as far as I could tell.
they were under
they
development when we were there.
Read. Yeah, okay.
But hey, they're reading at least.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Since our visit, one or two interactive exhibits for children have opened. One is called Dino Rubbing. Yeah, you're not getting that image out of your head. But it is a fallen world, so there you go. Still, there's quite a bit less for children to do than there would be at the average science museum.
And that's legal in Kentucky, right? Never mind. So when I left the museum, oh boy, yeah. I disappointed myself with that joke. When I left the museum, I was convinced that Ken Ham was simply fleecing Christians. From top to bottom, that place is designed to suck money out of Christians' pockets. A huge proportion of the books sold there are by Ham and the people he works with. Almost every page on the Answers in Genesis website links back to the online gift shop. If you ever want to leave this labyrinthine hell on earth, you have to go through the gift shop. That's, you know, similar to just about any tourist attraction. They even have one of those coin funnels where you drop the coin in the slot on the side, and your money spirals away from you, and then it falls into Ken Ham's bucket. And they really like, see what happens when you drop a coin in. We get your coin. After I saw what little they had to offer, selling a 2-day pass seemed just obscene to me. Once you've been a skeptic for a while, you realize it is immensely profitable to sell people what they want to hear. The museum's motto, prepare to believe, is entirely wrong. The cynic in me would rephrase it, prepare to believe anything. A few people who come there are like us and frankly ill-prepared to believe 6,000-year-old Earth. Most, though, clearly already believe. I'm sure there are a few who don't have strong feelings either way and were perhaps dragged there by a family member or a friend. But I would say that the vast majority are reaffirming what they already believe. Ken Ham is repackaging his visitors' ignorance and selling it back to them at a very high price. My preconceptions, even after having written about Answers in Genesis for several years now, proved wrong. I left thinking this should not be a problem for scientists. But the damn fact remains that it's built on $30 million worth of donations. There's a demand for this lunacy. Ken Ham's dinosaurs are the apotheosis of style over substance, sensation over sentience, and silliness over science.
He worked hard on that.
Yeah. The museum is a ludicrous menace to science education and is thoroughly depressing. That so many of the kids we saw there will never have a chance to deal with reality on its own terms.
The two words that sprang to my mind when I thought about the Creation Museum afterwards were disappointing and confusing and claustrophobic. The three words, sorry, I'll stop now. Anyway, I kept thinking, this is it? Is this it? I didn't expect to be convinced by their arguments. I'm not sure what I did expect, but I expected more than this. They constantly preach at you from science, from video, from audio, all of them going on at the same time. And other than that, they've got special effects. And that's kind of it. This sense of disappointment is best symbolized by the 6-minute film on the 6 days of creation. The film consists of someone reading chapter 1 of Genesis really slowly. You can look at it. It's not that long. Admittedly, it's accompanied by pretty pictures of Adam and Eve watching a brontosaurus frolicking in the sunset. But after a short amount of time, I actually said to Bob...
Can I put that in my list?
Yeah. I said to Bob, I've read the book and left. Because... yeah, that's it. Also, chronology is important to a lot of museums. Art museums are arranged according to time, period, and style. History museums follow a chronology. But those are designed around large rooms, and you can focus on the bits you're interested in. Chronology is absolutely central to the Creation Museum. The bulk of the experience is walking through the book of Genesis. But they keep taking you out of the timeline for films or to view the consequences of the fall, and then spit you back into it. It's confusing. And then there are those huge bottlenecks of people. Now, it may have been unusually crowded when we were there because of the time of year, but it's mostly the design of the place that causes these problems. First, there's all that reading to do. I just wish it was a more interesting story like Jane Austen or Beowulf. Or Jane Austen as written, never mind. On top of that, there are few open spaces. Mostly there are little rooms and narrow alleys, or walkways. And the result is bottlenecks. The Creation Museum must be aware of this problem because they have signs telling you it's permissible to move ahead, which is great, except that the place is so reliant on chronology that if you move ahead, you miss part of the story, and sometimes quite a lot of the story because you have these, there, you have to walk through past a whole lot of people to get to an empty space. If I were a believer, I might almost consider it blasphemy. And I mean, I don't mean that entirely snarkily. You know, you're supposed to be experiencing the wonder of creation, the horror of the fall, and the consequences of sin, and blah, 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 blah. That didn't sound right, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the miracle and wonder of Genesis. And, you know, just jumping ahead to, well, it's like, well, I'm on the ark now. I was in Eden, now I'm on the ark, I'm confused. But that's what you get, confused. Now, finally, as we've said, probably the Creation Museum is not going to convert a lot of people. However, people who are, and if any of you have been converted tonight, we've got just the thing for you, or the Creation Museum has just the thing for you. A conversion card. It's like a little credit card where you can write about your conversion with the date, the expiration number.
And we're happy to take any questions that you may have.
I can put on my glasses so I can hear.
Anybody got any questions? Anybody got a question?
What do you see as the long-term effect of propagating false science on society here in America, and the long and short-term effect of that? Because a lot, you're talking about the children looking at it and people that just blindly believe this stuff. What do you see as the effect?
You know, I have a... I kind of see this in a couple different ways. I have a strong suspicion that a lot of the things that make groups like this necessary, you know, we meet and we, you know, talk about the things that people believe, is that people no longer believe in the opinion of experts. And I don't know exactly what that is. It's like maybe it's the democratic impulse that all men are created equal, and then some of us learn more than others, or, you know, specialize in things, and, you know, differences crop up. There seems to be, I think the long term, it doesn't look good for science if this is the type of thing that passes as a good museum. There was, you know, the reason why there's so much text there is because they don't have a lot of stuff. I think it's pretty bleak. Although at the same time, it's such a shabby exhibit, there should be no problem knocking it down. At least from a scientific point of view, it's a matter of...
Well, there shouldn't be, but, you know, there's that thing of the sign about we have the same facts, except that's not true. They've made up a whole bunch of their own. They really have. I mean, the thing about the finches, and there are things like that over and over. They just say things that are not true. And obviously there's nothing there to question them. The other thing that's concerning, because, again, the museum itself as an experience, I don't think is converting a lot of people, but as part of a larger movement, Answers in Genesis, if you look at the bookshop, they have a lot of stuff that's aimed at homeschoolers.
It's true.
So they're raising generations of people who are being exposed to not science and not history, and not even good theology or understanding of the Bible. And that's really what's worrying, I think.
Hey, how many kids were at the museum, and what was their reaction when they saw the exhibits? I mean, were they like bored to tears, or were they, you know, excited or whatever? Or were there just no kids there? I don't know.
There were plenty of kids.
I would say that it was at least half kids. I mean...
Well,
you think so?
I don't know. I don't look at children, but there seem to be plenty there. They are polite, mostly.
They're very well-behaved children.
They like the dinosaurs, as far as I could tell.
And,
and they listen to Ma and Pa lecture them. And by lecture, I mean read the signs verbatim at them, which they did.
But, you know, I didn't interview any kids.
Yeah.
Because... That'd be a little creepy.
Yeah.
But yeah. But there were a lot of kids there, and they were being fruitful and multiplying.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying, skeptics, is get out there, you know? Get her done.
They weren't being fruitful and multiplying while we were there, because that would be wrong.
That would be wrong.
I'm not sure I understand the fascination with dinosaurs, how that goes into sort of their, whatever they're trying to present. It seemed to me you'd be more likely for them to say, oh, there weren't any dinosaurs, and all the fossils are, you know, fake fossils or whatever. So I don't understand how they're trying to incorporate the dinosaurs.
Well, the idea is that the Bible says that all land animals were created at one time, and therefore, if there were dinosaurs, they must have been created at that time, too. Therefore, man and dinosaur, and Grendel lived together.
Right? Well, another important thing is science, human reason, says dinosaurs died out slightly more than 6,000 years ago. But they did exist, so you can't have a, you know, according to human reason and science, you can't have both dinosaurs and a young Earth. So you have to do something to get those dinosaurs in the young Earth, and it involves the Ark in some way.
How do y'all recommend that we deal with this ideology when we encounter it, since no amount of rational thought or evidence can overcome delusional thinking?
Well, that's really quite depressing.
Yeah.
No, but there are many ways, and there is a lot of debate about the best way to approach people about these things. I would say do not be afraid to, one, educate yourself about the facts regarding evolution. There are innumerable resources, and a lot of, you know, fairly popular writing that has come out in the last, you know, 10 years or so that deals with evolution. And be prepared when you hear people at the Einstein Bagels, feel free to slide in and, you know, oh, this is really interesting. Well, how do you say this? The other thing that you can do is make them say out loud what they believe. Sometimes it, you know, so you believe that you ask them, did people hunt dinosaurs? Or do you believe that those really sharp teeth that the T-Rex had were for opening coconuts, like Ken Ham says they were? Yeah. No.
Before the fall, you mean?
Yeah. Because, there was no death before the fall. Therefore, the dinosaurs weren't eating smaller animals. Therefore, clearly, the razor-sharp teeth of doom were used for opening coconuts.
What?
Yeah, I know. And how, you know, a plant dying doesn't count as death, I don't know either. But you make them say it out loud because it sure sounds kind of dumb. Of course, there is a flip side to that. Once you start convincing yourself of increasingly ridiculous things, which this museum is a testament to, you find it easier to accept a lot of stuff. So, yeah.
So, did you hear anybody comment on any of the unorthodox theology? So, I mean, like, a lot of these people you know, they're all Christians, so they might have been different brands of Christian. They could have been being confronted with some of the weirder chunks of Ken Ham's personal theology for the first time. Did anybody say anything?
I did not hear anyone questioning boo, except there was one other group of people who we suspect may have been skeptical. But as for the amongst the believers, I didn't hear anything that suggested they in any way questioned anything.
In fact,
of course, we weren't listening to absolutely everything everyone said. Plus, there's the constant audio loops and video loops.
You really do get overwhelmed by the constant repetition, which, of course...
And people yelling, Jedediah, come here.
Yeah.
Bring your sister Tiffany.
Don't touch the prophet. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. No. I forget where I was going. Complete brain fart. I apologize. It's gone. It's not coming back.
Did I hear you say that the museum had a model of the Lucy skeleton?
Yeah. Wasn't it in the same room as the archaeologist, the Christian archaeologist and the Asian real archaeologist?
It was a cast. Yeah.
Do they account for the difference in the shape of the skull and the bones of Lucy compared to modern man?
I don't remember. I mean, I know the usual explanation is it's either an ape, completely, totally, 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 or it's human, completely, totally, totally, totally. And I don't remember which one they said.
Well, it was this tall. So
they're probably
ape.
Saying ape, yeah.
You know.
Just my understanding is from dealing with these weirdos for a long time is that they view the Australopithecines like Lucy to be chimpanzees and the more... obviously human-like skeletons like Homo erectus and habilis as being human with deformities.
Yeah, well, although sometimes I think even within the same group, that different examples within the same group, they come up with different explanations for them. So.
But if you look at this here, they have those enigmatic Neanderthals. Those
did not have grooming tools.
Yeah, they're just people. You know, they're just folk. You know? You would think that someone like Georgia Purdom, who's a molecular biologist, would point this out, but she's a moron. No, I mean, I can't think of, she's blind. I mean, she really does have huge blinders on. It's really ridiculous. Yes? Yes.
As near as you can tell, for the founders of the museum, what do they think is the purpose of the museum? Is it to convert? Is it to show that there's a movement that has a presence? Or is it to say, well, scientists have museums, so we have a museum too, therefore we're equal? I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
I think it's to say we too are scientists. Okay. Or at least that's part of it.
Yeah. I would say yes. Yeah.
And it gives them more authority because whenever a story comes up and the media's search for balance, they'll go to Ken Ham, founder of Answers in Genesis and the CEO of the Creation Museum, and you know, as if he had
authority.
Equivalence or authority to.
He has a museum of sorts.
Yeah.
He has a beard. Kind of looks a little bit like Dr. Zayas, you know, ironically.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Okay, we'll take one more question.
Come on, I want to get another ad hominem.
There's a question.
Oh, that's hard. That's just
the most egregious thing in the museum.
So you knew a lot about creationism before you went to the museum, obviously, but did you find anything there that you didn't expect to find?
I was pretty up on the Answers in Genesis. I was not totally surprised. There was the avarice bit. Maybe I'm reading into his motives because there's so many ways that you can buy stuff from Ken Ham. I did not realize that.
I guess what surprised me, perhaps not that much, is just some of the very odd, it seemed to me, biblical interpretations. Where, I mean, this is a group, their point of view is the Bible says what it means. It means what it says, and here's what it says. You know, don't look at what it actually says, because here's what it actually means. So, really, that sacrifice thing, one sentence, wow, you're getting a lot of it out of that sentence. And there were other examples of that. Also, they don't like the Catholics. But I wasn't surprised by that either.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting them to have a figure of Martin Luther nailing up a letter to his friend. That was kind of interesting, too.
Apparently. That's what he did. It was just a dear Bill.
Guess what I thought of.
And then later, him going, oh, God, what did I send Bill? That's my
favorite. It's okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on.